Pardon?
How was your Shabbos?
I meant any questions concerning the Parsha, concerning Torah. My Shabbos is very nice.
Yes,
how was yours? I'm sure yours was also nice.
You had...
Okay. I'm pleased to be back.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question. So, something interesting. So, with regards to Korach, he was in a very high level in Torah, right? So everybody knows that. And he wanted to...
Yeah, I'm going to speak about that. It may already be an answer to your questions. Concerning Korach, there are many questions which you already dealt with in part. I want to give you a clue. Good morning, everyone. No, Rashi says that Parsha Zu Yofi Nidreshes. This Parsha of Korach is explained in the Midrashim in a very good fashion. So let's try to understand its deeper meaning. And one of the Midrashim defined in the Gemara concerns the explorations of Rabbi Baba Chana, who was apparently a worldwide explorer and traveled to many different countries. And there are there are 21 stories of his adventures all over the world. And the 14th adventure is was making exploration of the desert of Sinai. An Arab merchant said to me, so Rabbi Baruch Hono said, it was a great Talmud Chacham as well, but he felt it was significant to explore many different places. Come, he said, it's Gemara in Bava Basra, page 74, I will show you the opening of the ground which swallowed up Korach and his family. I went and I saw two cracks in the ground. And these two cracks were emitting smoke. So came along the Arab merchant. He took some wool shearings and he soaked them in water. And he stuck them on the pointed head of a spear and inserted them there into the cracks. And when he withdrew them, they were scorched, singed. So the Arab merchant said to me, go and put your ear to those cracks and see what they're saying. Do you know what they were saying? You haven't heard this story before, any of you? What were they saying? Which we sing when we sing it on Simchas Torah. Moshe, how did the Nigun go? Anyone knows? Moshe Emes, Veserosa Emes. Moshe is true, and his Torah is true, Vehein Badaim, and we ourselves are really deceivers, contrivers, those who plotted evil. So the Arab merchant said to me furthermore, Kol Tlatinium, in every 30 days, they get shaken up, and Gehinnom brings them round here, like meat that is boiled and stirred in a cauldron. And this is what they say, Moshe Emes, Veserosa Emes. So So, I think this is the key to understanding this whole episode. Let me see, can any of you explain it, what it means?
It means that they realized that Moshe was wrong.
Well, I'm going to give you an interpretation which is to a great extent from the interpretation of my great-grandfather, who was the Aruch Lanez is known, but also with an element which we worked on last week to try to understand. Many unique aspects of yesterday's parsha and what is the significance. So I think the key is given in these words, Moshe Emes V'Sirot Emes. Because let's first start with a recap of a few other items that are mentioned or in Chumash Rashi, where it says when he went and took the talit, which is entirely made of sky blue, of techelet, and he asked the question, does it need tzitzit or not? This is the graphic description of what it says in the Chumash. What did it claim? He said, we all heard, all the people of Israel heard Hashem give the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. And therefore all of us are equal in holiness. Since we all merited to this, there were 3 million people merited to hear it. So they were all the same. And as some put it, he wanted to put forward, after democracy is a basic principle of the Torah, you go after the majority. And therefore, if you follow the majority constantly, you can't go and say there are permanent heads who decide what is right and wrong for the nation, even for all generations. Okay, Moshe heard, and we know that Hashem spoke to Moshe when he gave the Decalogue, but he also spoke to all of us. I mean, there are many midrashim, the Anuchim, Hashem Elokecha is addressed to the individual, to every individual heard the words of the Torah. And we want to discuss this, every person, Am Yisrael at that time, they were raised almost to the level of prophecy. So that applies to the Decalogue. But what about all those passages which you find after his lips in the passages by Midbar, which you find where it says Hashem spoke to Moshe telling him other mitzvot that is really, as far as the rest of the nation is concerned, why should we always rely on him? We'll give our own interpretation, even of the Decalogue, because we all heard it. And therefore, Kol Ha'eda Kulam Kedoshim, all of them are holy. Et Talit Shekula Techelet, all of them reached the highest level of closeness to Hashem. They all were able to fulfill the concept of Techelet, which is Tachlit, as we described. And therefore, why should we accept the Decalogue? No, we don't accept the absolute truth of everything that Moses said. He made it up. He said Hashem spoke to him, but we don't know about it and all other things. That was his claim. And if you look carefully through the parsha, apparently the build-up of his party made of different groups. They said, for example, who says that the firstborn, that generally is the leader, or even the spiritual leader, the rest of the family, that should be taken away from all the firstborn and given to the tribe of Levi? And who said that Aaron has to be the high priest? It doesn't say that in Decalogue. And therefore others can be high priests. And then they got together, different groups. So tribe of Reuven, of course. They say Reuven was the really firstborn. And then the heads of the different tribes claimed that, you know, we represent all the tribes of Israel. We the heads. And therefore, we also are going to join the party of Korach to say, Moses is making things up himself. And that was his claim. And the sages say that why is he called Korach? Korach really means Korach, a bald patch, because he created a bald patch in the giving of the Torah. So, if you look at it more carefully, I would say that the key is as follows. Or some say he denied the divinity of the Torah. Correct. But if you look carefully in the words Moshe Emet, Torato Emet, he also denied the prophecy of Moshe. He didn't deny the Decalogue. So therefore, he is the prototype, when together with the others involved, who for different reasons claim, if you look in their deeper motivations, that the Chumash, okay, it may be a mosaic composition. I'm using the mosaic with a capital M. That means that Moses composed it. Maybe Moses had divine inspiration, okay? He composed it. But there are other ways in which you can interpret it. We also believe in the Decalogue. And if you go back in history, therefore, their claim was, first of all, Moshe Emet. They did Teshuvah, Moshe Emet, Torato Emet. As you know, some of them did complete Teshuvah, and they were able to come out from this Gehinnom. This is not the usual type of Gehinnom, because the earthquake, not an ordinary earthquake, it was covered over entirely afterwards, and they disappeared, as though they never existed. There's no split left, except these two little things of smoke came out. It means they're burning constantly. So, I think the key is that, and you asked the question last week already. We have this apparent contradiction in the Rambam, but we can answer that question. We also answer the question why Moshe Rabbeinu had to make, as it were, a new creation, Yesh Me'ayim, that there should be this situation, because he wanted to emphasize, Moshe Rabbeinu, that Lo Milibi, Aaron and Moshe, they did not of their own accord say anything. It all came from Hashem. How can he demonstrate that whatever he said and was written in the Sefer Torah, and he wrote in the Sefer Torah, that it came directly from Hashem? It's lo milibi. It doesn't come from my mind at all. So, we know that the Torah, the Torah Shebichtav was written by Moshe, and the Torah Shebal Peh was also, it says begin with Pirkei Avot, which describes the development of Torah Shebal Peh, that Moshe kibbeh Torah Misinai. In other words, he received the Torah, not only the Aseret HaDibrot, but the whole of the oral tradition he received from Sinai, and from the way in which Sinai afterwards became a continuous divine revelation in the center of the sanctuary. Mibein HaKruvim, that was really a continuation of Sinai. So, this, in other words, is the prototype of what we can say the true development of the Torah of Hashem, and also how to understand the different groups amongst Jews and then amongst Gentiles, who recognize that the Aseret HaDibrot, which were after all inscribed in stone, and they were given in front of 3 million people. So therefore, we can say that until today, the strongest moral force amongst all the nations of the world is the Decalogue. The question, how do you interpret it? So we've had in the course of generations, following Korach, we had also even, especially in the time of the first temple, there were also many false prophets who said, and they brought the Jews to think that just like the golden calf, they thought they could interpret the Torah as well. Since they didn't see Moshe anymore, they could interpret it their way. So therefore, if you study carefully the rebellion of the first temple period by some of the kings and by many of the people, they said this, in part, they still followed the Torah, but they followed interpretation. They said, well, you know, Baal worship, since we don't have Moses today, we can even follow some of the concepts of Baal worship, that means worship Hashem through nature, through the phenomena of nature. At the same time, we'll keep Hashem, we'll also keep close to Hashem. This is partly the battle which Eliyahu Navi had to battle with also the leaders of the northern kingdom, as well as many of the nation. And they had to tell them, how long are you going to hop along on two different versions? If the Baal is an expression, after all, the Elohim Achirim is the same name ultimately. So therefore, it's easier for us to regard the Baalim, so much responsible, according to the nations around, for the fertility of the land. So let's make sure we'll combine it also with serving Hashem. That's what you should tell them. If you want to worship Baal, then you should know you're going entirely against the true God. You want to worship the true God. So when they saw what happened, they said, okay, we recognize now through these miracles which happened on the Har HaKarmel, Hashem Hu Elokim, and not the Baalim. And now this situation continued in the time of the second temple. Only idolatry had become weakened. In its place came denial and faith, came like Greek influences, who said that with our own mind we can decide what's right and what's wrong. And the Tzedukim arose, the Sadducees, who said we have to accept the written text of the Chumash, but we'll interpret how we think, not according to the ways of Torah Shebaal Peh, which we deny. We deny the authority of Torah Shebaal Peh. After the Tzedukim, the destruction of the temple, there came the Karaites. And the Karaites, they said, we accept the Bible, yes. It was inspired by Moses, but we don't accept the oral tradition. Who says? We go different. We just follow the text according to our interpretation. The same time, in the Second Temple period, there arose Christianity. They also said, early Christians, many of them were Jewish people, they said, we'll accept the Decalogue, yes, in all its entirety, but the oral tradition that is carried on till today, we don't accept. We don't have accepted. And that carried on in Christianity. Then later, the same thing happened with the Quran. Muhammad said, Moses was indeed a great prophet, and we accept Moses. But Muhammad was a greater prophet, and therefore he interpreted things a bit differently. The Christians developed then, because of more in accordance with also Greek thinking, that they said that, you know, human beings can also be godly and they'd be son of God and so on. All these things were like a reinterpretation, not only the Chumash, but the whole Tanakh. And because they based it on the Greek concepts, which also come through in the Septuagint, which was the earliest translation after the Aramaic one, but the earliest translation which made it possible for all those who followed Greek culture to see the wisdom in the Bible. But according to interpretations which were influenced by the Greeks and which developed also Christianity. And then came the Muslims, in some ways much better, because they did believe in the pure spiritual power of the one God. They believed they were, and many of them accepted also the Noahide code. And many interpreted even the Quran. You've got to accept the Noahide code. And they accept belief in Muhammad as greatest prophet. And therefore, until today, a Jew is not allowed to pray in a church, but a Jew is allowed to pray in a mosque because of this concept. But in our times, we have amongst the Muslims, unfortunately, which is not according to the interpretation of many of the moderate Muslims, but even earlier times, there were also some Muslims who developed concepts, say we've got to annihilate all the Jews and all those who don't believe in our interpretation. And this has reached a level when we find that suicide, which is clearly a prohibition for all human beings, mentioned already in the revelation to Noach. So anyone who accepts really the simple text of what's written clearly in the Chumash, it is a complete prohibition to commit murder and to commit suicide. And that the moderate is Muslims still accept today. But unfortunately, the violent distortions of the different warring and constant strife between the different groups amongst the Muslims, and one group says the other group, they have to be murdered in a cruel manner, and they do it all in the name of Allah. I mean, this is already such a destructive blasphemy to believe in God that he should be willing to support such methods of suicide bombing, which means also killing many innocent people and all cruel murders and adopting the Nazi methods constantly. This is such a distortion which endangers today all human beings on a very strong level. So this demonstrates to us, this is all Korach. That's the seed of it. It starts with not accepting the true oral tradition of Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai. And that's why it's as surprising. Which comes first? The heavenly power of the whole Torah or the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu? Which comes first? Surely Torah Min HaShamayim. And the Rambam himself, he says that anyone who denies in Torah Min HaShamayim, it's clear that he's not descended from those people who stood and heard Hashem speak at HaSinai. And one of the proofs he brings is from Korach. And in his letter to Teman, he says that surely a person who denies heavenly Torah, so his ancestors did not stand at the foot of Mount Sinai. So how do you explain Korach? So the answer is, Korach did not deny that the Torah which was given at Sinai explicitly and heard by all the people. That was one of his bases for all his arguments. That is holy. After all, that was written even by Hashem himself, it says, in the tablets of stone. But the rest of the Torah, you can interpret according to points of view. Vox populi, vox Dei, let the people of Israel decide how to interpret it. Each one interpret it like he wants. And this has even led to the situation, I'd say, not only the concept that Moses made up himself, Mosaic. Today, in fact, there are many books written against biblical criticism, even by the non-Jews, and also accepted by many of the Jews. They say we can prove from many different sources that there's a unity of the Pentateuch. It must have been produced by the same person, as it is, and it's divine, but it all was produced by Moses, Mosaic. That's one level, from which one can even take a lot of arguments against the Bible critics. But there's another way of writing Mosaic, which was developed by Wellhausen, who was an anti. I can tell you a lot about that. So Wellhausen and other originated Bible criticism, which also included some extent Spinoza. So they don't say it's Mosaic with a capital N. They made it Mosaic with a small M. What's the meaning in English of mosaic? With a small M.
It's like the tiles that they use to many pieces.
Little pieces in different colors. That's a mosaic. So I'll tell you, over 100 years ago, it produced what's called the Rainbow Bible. And I had to deal with it in my younger years in order to produce a work to remove the dogmas of biblical criticism. So the Rainbow Bible is like this. They think, in fact, the only way they can explain the Bible, they say the different names given to Hashem, the different parts of the Bible, so they cut it into pieces. And they produced a Bible which is a complete mosaic, a colored Bible. I saw that colored Bible. Each color represents a different author, and it's put together somehow by editors. And that's how they want to explain many things. It all starts with the two names of Hashem. That's where Wellhausen started. Of course, in other words, mosaic. From mosaic with a capital M, we have the extreme Bible critics who put a small M. And shall I tell you something? I was in a college in London, so the lecturer followed this theory, and I prepared different passages in the Chumash and in the Tanakh, according to our classical commentators. The Maran is one of the greatest, and Rafish and others. And I showed how stupid it is, and how it's based upon really the attempt to dissect the Bible. And I was able to show that the dissection of the Jewish people, to cut them up into pieces, was based to some extent upon the dissection of the book of the people, of the Bible. And how unfortunate it is that there's so many lecturers in the universities who are Jewish, and they go and cough up these stupid theories. That's what's taught in some lectures at Hebrew University, do the same. And they can be demolished so easily on any point of logic. But this is part of the real motivation, subconscious and sometimes even consciously, of some of the Bible critics. I mean, Solomon Schechter was an enormous scholar. He was very open-minded. He studied all the works of the Bible critics. And he said, Bible criticism, anti-Semitism. And higher Bible criticism, which is one about the Rainbow Bible, there's a higher anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, there's so many Jews, even today, who know too little. And you find them. I've had students here also, students came from Hebrew University. Have you learned the Bible? Yes. I've learned the documentary theory. Yeah? That they know about. But they never really even studied Hebrew properly. Certainly not Hebrew of the Chumash. And that's one of the problems we're faced with in this country. And that's that there's so many who think that the most anti-Semitic theoretical theories against the Bible, this is what's called Western culture. It's out of date already. Today it's no longer accepted by the majority of the scholars, can be shown as well. Everyone realizes this is mosaic authorship with a small M. But with a large M, you still have it sometimes. But most of those lecturers who do believe in Mosaic, or in their books and their lectures, Mosaic with a large M. One of the main reasons they do it, they really believe, and I've found it with many of them, they believe it can't be a Mosaic. There can be no human being who can produce a text of this type. It's not possible. And even today with the codes, if we go on the traditional aspects of the codes, which were accepted by some great mathematicians, which you already find in 1,000 years ago, there was a great biblical scholar called the Rokeach, and he had a computer mind, and he showed that the letters in the Tanakh, and certainly the number of times a word is repeated in the Tanakh, all have a significance. We have here text, the pattern of seven and the multiples of seven goes all the way through the Tanakh. And therefore, there are books written by great top mathematicians before the age of the computer. And now with the age of the computer, this has become very popular. Therefore, some of them have taken it too far. They think it's arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. It works according to system. And those who follow the system, like you find in some of the earlier people who dealt with the codes, that there's a brilliant mind, one of the great people who was altogether a huge genius called Weissmantel. So he's more known for trying to get the nations of the world to destroy the plans of the Nazis to destroy the Jewish people. And in this he was very active, and he sent plans of Auschwitz to all the authorities he could and asked them, please bomb Auschwitz. And he showed them exactly where they can bomb it and when they should bomb it. They didn't take much notice, and the Jewish authorities also didn't, unfortunately. But at the same time, he was a huge genius in the codes, because his mind was like that. He was able to memorize almost every letter of the Chumash. So they followed the codes. He demonstrates the codes on the base of Jewish tradition. Today they've gone a bit beyond, because you can't make codes on the basis of transliterations which are arbitrary. In other words, once you extend it, that you'll find in the Chumash reference, let's even to Obama. You can spell Obama in Hebrew transliteration in probably 6 or 7 different ways, whether you put an aleph in or whatever, different things you put in. And therefore, once you transliterate, when I ask some of those who've gone a bit far in this, what do you base yourself on to translate in this fashion? On the whole, they say we follow the major authoritative dictionary of Hebrew of today. Well, that's not part of the Tanakh. You've got to bring a proof from the Tanakh itself, which is the way in which the traditional codes work. For example, the Mizmor we read this morning, 67, there, it's based upon the menorah, as explained in earlier shiurim, and you find that the middle verse has 49 letters, and the number of words in the whole psalm is 49. So you see, there's a symbol here, and you can work it. So these are the symbols that connect all this filat ha'omer. So there that's something based upon Jewish traditions. All this begins with acceptance of Torah Shebaal Peh. That's why the key is, although Torah Mishnah is greater, but what was it wasn't that Korach denied divine authority. He said, yes, the Decalogue is divine. But how to interpret the rest of the verses of the Chumash, that everybody can have his opinion. That goes on till today. Many say it depends on opinion. While Torah Shebaal Peh goes according to special traditions, and also the authority, the greatest wise masters of the oral tradition, they make up the Sanhedrin. And amongst them you follow the majority, how to decide things. And that's the basis of all the Gemara. How does it continue when there's no Sanhedrin? You also have to take the greatest masters of Torah Shebal Peh. And that's why they, what they keep on, Moshe Emes, the Terosa Emes. Because Moshe was the true prophet, above all other prophets, and therefore the Torah of Moshe, the Torah Shebal Peh, is also true for all generations. And that's the important. And anyone who dies, it creates bald patches. So there are sections of the Jewish people that disappear. Like the northern kingdom disappeared in the end because of this. Because they were so far removed from accepting belief in Hashem, exclusive monotheism. They said, they still need a mean, a certain power in between. So it means the power of the natural fertility of the land, which was worshipped by the Canaanites exclusively. And the Jews said, we can accept it as well as Hashem. We know Hashem is the ultimate creator, but he's created a middle power of the power of natural fertility, which is also worthwhile worshipping. We'll get better results. That was their sin. And the second Beit HaMikdash, the Tzedukim. What happened? 10 tribes disappeared. A huge patch. They disappeared. Well, they still, we know there are remnants of them you find all over the world today. You know, what people who still keep customs from the time of the 10 tribes were scattered all over the world. And then you have the Tzedukim that assimilated more to the world ways of the Greeks. That was partly the predecessor to Christianity, Christian Jews, and then after Christian developed. And then you have the Karaites, and that also produced the ambivalence of Muhammad himself. Muhammad himself first wanted to become a Gadzedek. His first teacher was a Rav who followed Torah entirely. But we need to, and also one of his wives was Jewish and so on. He felt he wanted to, that's how he found out the idolatry of the Bedouins amongst whom he was wrong. You've got to remove yourself from that and follow Jewish teachings. But then when he had certain illusions about himself and divine revelation, you know, thought is like people that they also come in. You get many people who think they're Moshiach or something like that. So also he thought he's got divine revelations. God spoke with him. I've also met people, a person comes to the yeshiva and says, God told me this, that, and the other. So today you send him to get psychiatric help, yeah? Like this, I heard yesterday a story that somebody showed up by Steinemann recently. Somebody said it's a true story. And he came to Steinemann and said, I'm Elijah the prophet, yeah? So he was a nice person, and he said, I want to get a blessing from you. I said, of course, I'm a blessing, but please sit down. And then he said, it says in the Gemara, more than 1,000 times, there are many questions left in the Gemara. What is it called when you can't answer it? What's it called in the Gemara? If there's a certain question, whether there's no answer given. Teiku. So some explain that teiku means it remains an open question. Teheikoi, it remains a question. We don't have to answer it. And you know, if it's a draw in a game of chess, what do you say in Hebrew? Teiku. It's a draw. We don't know who won. Don't know who's great enough. Teiku. Also in the Gemara, there's a dispute of some whom, according to whom is the halacha? Teiku. And there are thousands. So Rav Steinemann said, oh, if you're Elijah, well, perhaps you can answer some of these questions. So he started to ask, he took out the Gemara. He said, look, here it says teiku. Teiku means tishbi, yataretz, kushis, vabod. Gemara also often says, if there's something you don't know, you've got to wait for Elijah the prophet to answer it. Yeah, the even case where it says explicitly that. And teiku means tishbi, yataretz. Who's tishbi? Eliyahu tishbi. Elijah will answer all difficult questions. He'll answer all those questions. Yep. Like it's well known when people ask the question to Briska or Beis HaLevi, the next Briska, ask some questions. What's going to happen when the Mashiach comes? But he says, we'll have to ask him. Wait till he comes, then you can ask him. Before that, we don't really know. The Rambam says the same thing. We don't know exactly how it will happen. Until it happens, Mashiach will come. It's a anyway, so he asked him a Gemara where it says Eliyahu. He couldn't answer any of the questions. Yeah? When this person claiming that I'm Elijah, and he couldn't answer any questions, so he ran out of the room. Yeah. So, this is the concept of the bald patch created. So on the basis of this, going a bit further, what time is it? Oh, it's too late. Okay. So tomorrow, if you're interested, because it's gone quite far, I want to give you a deep explanation of what Rabbi Baba Chone's explorations, what he found out. Many say that all these fantastic stories concerning Rabbi Baba Chone, they all contain, like all the Midrashim, a deeper teaching, important until today. So I think this one is also very important until today. And I just give you one of the other stories is that we said we're going in a famous story. We were going in a ship, and it was about to. It was quite stormy seas, and then we found an island, and then the island which had also been growing on it. So we went to that island, and we started staying there for a time. And then, whilst we were there a few days, we started cooking there. All of a sudden, the island turned right over, and turned, there was a gigantic whale. And if we wouldn't have been able, the only way we could save ourselves is to try and get back to the ship as quickly as possible. So one of the interpretations was given a few hundred years ago. This is a reference to the Intifada. What's the Intifada? Jewish people might come in the future, it said, might come back to Eretz Yisrael. It's written by the Tivot, gives it. He lived 300 years ago. The Jews might come back to the land of Israel in the ship. The Jewish people is the ship who go through stormy seas and try to survive as a nation. We come back to the land of Israel. And then we try settling on this island. That means the land of Israel appears to be a very nice island. And we can start settling there. And we start trying to plant trees. And we start living, cooking our food. And all of a sudden, it all turns over. And we're almost drowned, all of us. But we try to get back to the ship. The ship being the ship of Torah learning, Torah tradition, which gets us somehow to survive in the turmoil that surrounds us. So I saw someone apply this directly to the experience of thinking, oh, we come to Israel, and we've got here the many Arabs also in our country, and we're given help, Six-Day War, and the Arabs all feel they can live better in Israel than even live amongst their own nation in other countries, where they're all Muslims, but they feel they're getting better conditions here, which many of them feel even until today, and that's what we think as well. Sometimes the Arabs get work here better than they can get anywhere else. And they get paid better, and they get treated in the hospitals, and they get bituach lomi, and they get kupat cholim, and don't have to go to the army, and they have mamish a free ride here, and they can go where they want, and on the whole, the Jews don't attack them. Like last week, I was in a taxi. The taxi said, "Look, here, even in where was it in Gula?" He says, "You see, there's more Muslim taxi drivers than Israelis." We can't get the people to come on our taxes. They've taken it over. And it's true. Go in some hospitals and just surrounded by Muslims. Don't it? Muslims have some of the best conditions here in Israel. And if they would only, would you know, one day they can come, like happened here, the murderers who killed the people here, in the middle of davening, they knew the way in and out of all the shuls here. because they're regular workers here. You know, regular, give them work, still try to help. And now even the Mitnachalim, in the world today, they want to go and put all products, and even merits came up in our own government. Yeah, the extreme leftists, they came with a proposal there should be a general boycott, now they're joining BDS, and they say we've got to put on all the government has to insist it should say on all its products if they come from Yehuda v'Shomron. So Nachalim said, look, if you do that, then we'll have to, if you're going to do that, what, you think we can still employ? They're employing thousands of Muslim workers. Even some of them were given permission to come over from across the border and to work here. And they want it. So what do you want us to do? You who bring the boycott. All these will become unemployed. They won't have, because they don't have employment elsewhere. Okay, well, so this is the situation. Yeah.
So we have to treat everybody.
Depends.
Everyone meant to treat nicely. Huh? Maybe they wouldn't have done what they did if we were treating them nicely.
It's not true. No, it's not so. Let's say these who did the attacks here, they were treated very nicely. And they were people trusted them. They thought they'd. Often they keep it hidden. Not simple. It's certainly more advisable today, definitely, if you have a choice, don't go and treat them very nicely. But what happens? They go and it took Eitan. Well, everyone realizes it took Eitan. They all bring now the hate. They bring accusations. Get this: how they treat Palestinian children, and the fact they put their children in places where they are hiding in the ambulances or even in some of the vehicles. They have children there, and behind the children is a tent. That's from how they shoot. Because on the whole, if anybody in the army, they see children, they don't shoot. So sometimes they see a terrorist, they don't see all the children, the women and children, so they kill the terrorists. Many of the terrorists surround themselves, women and children. And from there, they show their grenades and their missiles from the hospitals and from ambulances,
from schools themselves.
And that is not condemned. No, that to use children as a shield and women as a shield, that is not mentioned in their reports. And many of the reports that they give when they find the army harming children, as has been shown constantly, they constantly strive to make videos which are a show. They're not really true. So many cases are with the other way around.